Chapter 1. A sharp shower pattering on the foliage of the sycamores and elms was scattering the equestrians in the row. Fair girls urged their hacks into a canter and trotted swiftly homewards. Other riders, glancing upwards, and deciding that the clouds had done their worst, drew up under the trees. Among these was a slight, graceful girl in a well-fitting habit with a pale, classic face, and a somewhat Venetian combination of dark brown eyes and red gold hair. With a slight wave of her whip to her groom who halted obediently under a neighboring tree, she reined in her slender-limbed bay mare under a horse chestnut tree whose shelter was still undemanded. There she sat still in her saddle, with a slight frown biting her lip as she asked herself again and again, "Did he see me? Has he ridden out of the park?" When she cantered along just as the shower began, she fancied she recognized an admirer she had believed to be far away, walking his horse in the same direction as herself. This was Lord Vensittart Tayman, who had several times repeated his offer of marriage, an offer she did not refuse because he had not stirred her heart, for she loved him, and passionately but for other reasons. Although it had caused her bitter pain, she had at least been determined enough in her note to send him off, in dudgeon, to seek forgetfulness in other climes. And now he had appeared again. Her first feeling had been dismay, mingled with involuntary ecstasy which startled her. Then came a wild, almost uncontrollable impulse just to speak to him, to touch his hand, to look into those love-laden eyes once more, only once more. She gazed furtively here and there, divided between the hope and fear that her longing would be sated, she would meet him. Riders passed and repassed. The little crowds gathered, thickened, dispersed. She was disappointedly telling herself that as the shower had temporarily subsided, she ought to be returning home, when her heart gave a leap. A rider who was trotting towards her was the Montaman, strongly if slightly built, handsome, fair, if stern, who alone among men had conquered that heart, who, although despair had driven her to hold her own against him, was her master. It was all over. Fate had decided they two must once more meet. There was no escape. He rode up. She blanched, but looked him steadily in the face. He gazed sadly, beseechingly, yet with that imperious, compelling glance which had so often made her quail, into those beautiful brown eyes. "We meet again, you see," he said, in a harsh, strained voice. He felt on the rack to him, wildly panting, yearning to take her in his arms after weary, maddening months of longing. That gulf between them seemed a very hell. "So it seems," she said, with a pitiful attempt at a laugh. "I thought you were in Kamchatka, or Bombay, or anywhere." "I have come back," he returned, lamely, mechanically accompanying her as she rode out of shelter. She would not, could not, stay there and bandy words with him. "I felt I must know the worst." Involuntarily she reined in, and so suddenly that she startled her steed, and it was some moments before the mare's nerves were calmed. Then she turned a white, set face upon her self-elected escort. "What do you mean, Lord Vensittart?" she asked scornfully, and her eyes flashed. "You know," he hoarsely said, "I am not so utterly vain as to think that where I have failed, other and more attractive fellows may not succeed. You know, or ought to know, that what you are saying is absurd." She faltered. What had she thought, feared? She hardly knew, she only felt a tremendous relief. Thank heaven, even had she been secretly vowed to the cloister, her conduct since their parting could not have borne closer scrutiny. "You must remember what I said. I never, never, intend to marry anyone. I shall never, never, change my mind about underscore that underscore." He said nothing, but glanced at her a curious glance. A puzzle to him, since he first had felt encouraged to believe, from symptoms which only a watchful, anxious lover would perceive, that she involuntarily, perhaps even unconsciously, loved him, she had remained an insoluble problem during the long days of their separation when he pondered on the subject the slow, lagging hours through, and, now again, she bid fair to be as great a problem as ever. For he felt, he knew, that her reception of him, her pallor, the strange look in her eyes and the curious pitch of her voice, why, the veriest fool alive would not have mistaken her demeanor or one of its details for indifference. I think you mistake yourself," he began slowly, revolving certain ideas which he had jotted down at intervals for his future guidance, in his mind. "I suppose you do not believe in marriage. You have seen its failure. Is that it?" "Perhaps," she said. "I really can't tell, myself. All I know is, that I am firmly resolved not to marry anyone." She spoke doggedly, with almost a childish obstinacy. "But you do not bar friendship?" he said, earnestly, appealingly. "Supposing someone of the unfortunate men you determined to have nothing to do with were to wish to devote his whole life and energies to you, secretly, but entirely with the absolute devotion of a would-be anchorite or martyr, what then? You would not refuse to give the poor devil a chance? I mean, to give him something in return, if friendship were too much to expect, tolerance, pity, a look now and then, or a word, you would allow him to play your faithful knight, of course in strict secrecy, from afar, unsuspected by the world? A faint color suffused her lovely face. She looked at him, furtively. Some people may care for that sort of thing, I don't. She bluntly said. Oh, Lord Van Sittert. Why will you not, can you not, see and understand that all I want of everyone is to be let alone? I have my own ideas of what my life should be, surely anyone professing interest in me ought to respect them. I respect your every thought, he eagerly, if somewhat perplexedly returned. Only I should like thoroughly to understand the kind of life you wish to lead. Because well, I will not beat about the bush. Joan. You know I love you. You are my very life. And if I cannot be nearer than I am now, my only happiness and motive for living must be to serve you in some way, to see you, speak to you, help you, be your very slave. Just as his voice was most impassioned, his appeal was interrupted. An elderly gentleman rode swiftly up and tapped him on the arm. Why, Van Sittert. Can I believe my eyes? He exclaimed, somewhat breathlessly. Joan, where has he dropped from? It was Sir Thomas Thorne, the wealthy uncle who had adopted Joan, his late brother's only child, at her mother's death a few years previously. The admired beauty, whose only flaw seemed to be her adamantine pose in regard to her many suitors, was known to be sole heiress of the wealthy baronet and his wife, who were not only childless, but curiously devoid of near relations. From Paris, Sir Thomas, he replied, as easily as he could. Then he gave a brief account of his wanderings. He seemed to have roamed and ranged over the earth, prowling about for some interest, which evaded him from Dan to Beersheba. Sir Thomas listened with a peculiar twist of his thin, fine lips and a curious twinkle in his shrewd, handsome old eyes. Coming to lunch, he genially, if abruptly, proposed, as they left the park. My lady will be delighted to see you. You are one of her particular favorites. What could Van Sittert do but accept? With many deprecatory glances at Joan which, as she rode on looking straight before her, she either did not, or would not see, he accompanied uncle and niece through the pale sunshine which now bathed the wet streets and shone upon the dripping bushes and bright green foliage of the trees, to the door of Sir Thomas' tastefully beflowered mansion in one of the largest West End squares. Here, before the groom had time to wait upon his mistress, he was off his horse, and at her stirrup. Forgive me, he pleaded, as she eluded his help and sprang lightly down. I could not resist the temptation. Had she heard him? She had marched on into the house. She will not appear at luncheon, he told himself bitterly, as he accompanied the very evidently friendly Sir Thomas up the steps and through the hall. She will make some plausible excuse to avoid me, as she has always done, worse luck. Chapter 2. But for once Lord Van Sittert's good star seemed in the ascendant. Joan was seated at the end of the long table in the big, finely furnished dining room, where luncheon was already being handed round by the men in Sir Thomas Fawn and silver livery to some ladies and a man or two who had dropped in and been invited to stay by Lady Thorne. As the kindly, middle-aged, motherly-looking lady welcomed him with what he felt to be pleasurable astonishment, he felt less sickened by the mingled scent of savory entrees and the pines, forced strawberries and rich rose blooms that decorated the luncheon table in profusion. Perhaps she seemed to smile upon him, almost to sympathize, indeed, as Sir Thomas had made no secret of doing some months previously his hostess might stand his friend in his hitherto dismally unsuccessful wooing. While he accepted a vacant place on her right hand, and chatted about his travels, his ear was pitched to hear what Joan was talking so brightly about to Lady Mound and her daughters at the other end of the table. He lost the thread of Lady Thorne's remarks, until she startled him agreeably by asking him whether they would meet him that afternoon at the concert at Dulwich House. "Are you as Miss Thorne going?" he stammered. "I of course I only arrived last night, but Lady Dulwich is such an old friend, I know I should be quite the underscore bienvenue underscore." "Joan, you are coming with me to Lady Dulwich's this afternoon, of course?" asked her aunt, when there was a lull in the conversation. "No? Why not?" "I am riding to Crouch Hill to see poor Nana," she said, and the determined tones of her resonant young voice seemed to strike upon Van Sittert's hot, perturbedly beating heart. "I know it is not a month yet since I went last. My uncle is an autocrat, as I dare say you know, Lady Mound. He only allows me to see my poor old nurse once a month. But I had a letter from her, she is worse than usual. I meant to have told you, Auntie, but you were busy, and I thought it did not matter." "It matters very much, unless you drive, for I cannot accompany you this afternoon," said her uncle, raising his voice so that his wife could hear. "Joan can drive with her maid, My dear. He was well aware that Joan detested driving accompanied by her maid. You can postpone it till tomorrow? I could not go with you then, Joan. I have to attend a meeting. Perhaps Van Sittert will spare time to escort you? You are not deep in engagements yet, I expect, my boy, are you? I should be only too pleased, if Miss Thorne will accept my services, as she has done on occasion in the hunting field, he said, with an effort not to betray his violent delight at such an opportunity to plead his cause. London is not the country, Lord Van Sittert, thanks, said Joan, calmly, although she had suddenly paled to lividity with dread, with the indescribable fear she felt of self-betrayal to this man who loved her. I shall be perfectly safe, alone. One only meets a few wagons and carts along the highroads. There was a slightly displeased expostulation from her uncle, a deprecatory word or two in favor of Van Sittert as her squire on the part of Lady Thorne, and Joan, desperate, capitulated, feeling unequal to being focused by all the pairs of eyes around the table. She went upstairs to change her habit and hat for one more suited to the muddy suburban roads, and presently found herself trotting northwards on her spirited gray mare Nora, Van Sittert at her side. She had chosen Nora, she coldly remarked she meant to be an icicle to Van Sittert. It was her only chance because she wanted a good gallop, and Nora had not been out that day. And as soon as the young mare had frisked and capered through the suburbs in a manner which made Van Sittert somewhat anxious, and effectually prevented conversation, she and her mistress bounded off in a canter, and literally tore along the soft roads, startling the few pedestrians and drivers of tradesmen's carts, Lord Van Sittert's horse galloping after, and the groom scampering in the rear to keep in sight of the pair. Joan only slackened speed for more than a few moments when she saw the row of cottages where old Mrs. Todd lived, at the foot of the wide sloping road that wound downhill. "There is the cottage," she said, pointing with her whip. "The poor old soul who lives in it loves me best in the world, and I think I return it with interest. She was my nurse when I was a child, helped my mother nurse my father through his long illness, then nursed her to her death, and only left me because she felt too helpless to be of any use. And now you make her life happy by seeing her now and then," he said, gazing passionately at the pure, white, girlish profile under the felt hat. "She can hardly be happy doubled up with rheumatism, lonely, poor. It is ridiculous to suggest such a thing," she said, disgustedly then, touching Nora's flank lightly with her heel, she rode off, he followed, springing down to assist her to alight. But she frowned at him. "You had better hold her, please," she suggested. "Where is that groom of mine?" "Oh, there he is. I shall be quite half an hour. You might inspect the neighborhood." "Thanks for the suggestion, perhaps I shall," he good-humoredly returned, with a scrutinizing glance at a stern old face framed by the cottage window panes, which disappeared as he looked, and as Joan slipped nonchalantly off her petting steed and went within, congratulating herself upon having furnished herself with a good chance of losing or evading him and returning alone, he decided to remain well out of sight of the cottage, but only where he could keep his eye on the groom and the horses. "Well, Nana, here I am, you see," said Joan, entering and embracing the worn old crone who stood leaning on her stick in the middle of the kitchen and parlor combined. It was a dark, low room, filled with some old-fashioned furniture remnants of Joan's vicarage home. A big old armchair stood by the fireplace, where there was a bright little fire, although in a few weeks it would be midsummer. "Sit down at once." She led her gently back to her chair. "Poor old dear. You have been bad this time, haven't you? You mustn't spare the doctor sent his bill to me. You got that chicken panada and jelly? That's right. I've brought some money for little things." "Never mind money, dearie. But tell me who's the gentleman?" said the old woman, whose large, shining eyes shone living in her emaciated, deathly face, shading her eyes with her skinny, claw-like hand, and gazing anxiously at Joan, who had drawn a low folding chair near and was seated opposite the fire. "I like his face, that I do. I saw him as you got down from your horse." "It is Lord Van Sittert," said Joan, frowning slightly. The old woman bent forward, and scrutinized her nursling's expressive features. "You like him?" she suddenly asked. "Oh, if you do, may the Lord be praised." Joan gave a bitter, hopeless laugh. "What good would it do me if I did?" she mournfully said. "What good?" The aged crone leant forward and clasped Joan's gauntleted wrists with her dark, claw-like hands. "Oh, my blessed darling. If you could only be married to a real gentleman like him and would forget all about that business, and that wretched chap, I should die happy, that I should. You have forgot him, haven't you, dearie?" Mrs. Todd gazed anxiously at Joan's gloomy, miserable, yet most beautiful eyes. There was a faraway look, a look of mingled dread and aversion, as if beyond all, she could see some loathsome, terrible object. "Forget the curse of my life?" she bitterly exclaimed. "For, while I do not know where he is, if he is alive or dead, my life is accursed. How dare I love, care for any good man, saddle anyone's life with my miserable folly, confess to any honest person my association with __. Why, I blush and groan and grovel and tear my hair when I think of it, and if my uncle knew, heavens, he might curse me and turn me out of doors and leave me to starve. He does not love me as if I were his own child, I know that. How can he, when he was at daggers drawn with my father all those years? And auntie, kind though she is only his wife, she is good to me because he wishes her to be. They are only pleased with me because I please in society people like me, like my looks. If they knew, oh, my God." She clasped her hands over her face, and writhed. The old woman's features worked, but her brilliant, unearthly eyes were riveted firmly on her darling. "You were once a great fool, dearie. But don't you be a fool now, never no more," she said, sonorously, solemnly. "There was summat you once used to say, poetry, when you was home from school. It did go right down into my heart like a bullet dropped into a well. Summat like a dead past daughter bury its dead. Can your uncle, or your aunt, or this lord who loves you, or me, or the finest parson or king or pope or anything or body in this world, bring back one single blessed minute, let alone hours or days? That's where common sense comes in, as your dear dead pa used to say to me often and often. No, you can't bring it back, nor he can't. It's dead. He's dead, that brute, and if he ain't dead to you, he can't worry or annoy you, being in prison. If he's alive, as a fellow of his sort is safe as sure to be." "Hush! For heaven's sake, Nana, don't talk like that." Joan trembled, and glanced a despairing, furtive glance out of the window above the pots of arums, and prickly cactus, and geranium cuttings, where the long, attenuated tendrils of the mother of thousands in the wire basket dangled in the draft. Much and often as she thought of her past, that secret past which only this faithful old soul really knew the facts of, she felt as if she could not bear it put into words. "Who's to hear? The girl's out!" exclaimed the old woman, who was roused, excited. Her nursling's troubles, the obstacles to her becoming a great lady, were to her the worst trials of her suffering, lonely life. "I tell you this, dearie, if you won't have anything to do with that splendid lord who loves you, and you say you like, I shall think you hanker after __. That viper who ain't fit to live, let alone to black that noble gentleman's boots. What you don't? Then what should stand between you and him as loves you? That nonsense of that fellow's? What do it matter if he's dead, or in prison? It's 4 years ago, ain't it? If you are so particular, you could wait another 3, and then he wouldn't have any sort of claim upon ye, if he has any now, which I doubt. He was humbuggin' of you, dearie. I'm not to talk about it? I must. I can't die happy till I know ye're safe with a good man as'll take care of ye, my pretty, and that's a fact. And I am sick and tired of all these aches and pains, it's such a weary world. Now, my dearie, when he asks ye to be his'n, and he'll do it, too, ah. I can see he's done it already, just you listen to him. Be engaged, as they call it, secret-like, for a time. Then don't go and tell him about all that which is dead and done with. Never tell living soul a word about __. But let him think it's one of the whimsies beauties like you are supposed to have. Make him wait. And then find out what's become of __. I'll help ye. I'll help ye." "You have heard from of him?" gasped Joan, wildly. "Nana! When? How? God is my witness, I've never set eyes on him, the vagabond, since ye showed him to me that day when he came with us in the fields, 5 year ago, when you was at school, and your poor mar was nearin' her end," she said, solemnly. "Letters? Not likely. You've had a letter from him? No, I knew you couldn't have had. Dumb convicts, hush? All right, then. If you'll listen to me, I'll hush and welcome." When Joan rose to go a few minutes later, her thoughts were in a frantic whirl, but there was a gleam of hope shining upon those dismal memories which stood between her and happiness. Still she glanced round as she issued from the cottage, hoping that her escort would not be in sight, and they would happen to miss each other. She wanted time to think, to ponder over new possibilities suggested by her old nurse's words, possibilities which seemed to her, numbed by her long battle royal to overcome her passion for Vansittart, too magnificent ever to become probable. And she mounted, and after a pretense of waiting about for him as they walked their horses slowly uphill, she said to her groom, "We had better go on, Sims," and quickening her pace, was presently trotting homewards. But Vansittart was calmly awaiting them at the crossroads, and reined round and accompanied her as a matter of course. She gave him a desperate glance as their eyes met, and it caused him to change his tactics. He had meditated an onslaught upon her emotions during their homeward ride. "It will keep," he sagely told himself, and after an uneventful canter and a little ordinary small talk he left her at her door without even an allusion to a next meeting. Chapter 3. She went to a room somewhat heavy-hearted. She was no woman of the world, and was taken aback by his unexpected change of manner. Her maid Julie was busy with a charming underscore toilette de bal underscore just arrived from Paris, a gauzy robe over satin, richly sewn with flowers and foliage made of tiny seed pearls. "This will suit Mademoiselle A. Merveille underscore," exclaimed the little Frenchwoman. "And with that pearl underscore garniture underscore. I shall not go out tonight," she said, with a disgusted glance at the finery which seemed such hollow mockery. And as soon as she had changed her habit for a tea gown, she locked herself in her boudoir, and stormily pacing the room, asked herself with this sudden chill in her love mend. "I have gone too far, I have been too cold, I have lost him," she told herself, wildly. "I cannot bear it. While there was the faintest of faint hope left that I might be with him someday, I could bear everything. But to see him look at me as if I were anybody, speak as if he did not care what became of me, no, no, I should soon go mad." Flinging herself prone on her sofa, she clasped her throbbing head in both hands, and asked herself passionately what could be done. "I cannot, must not, lower myself by writing to him, and then, if he was the same again, I could not take advantage of it. Was ever poor wretched girl in such a miserable position as I am?" All seemed hopeless, gloomy, dark, until a sudden thought came like a brilliant flash of light. "He may be there, he will be there, tonight. Of course, he is a friend of the Duchess," she told herself. That is what it meant. He knew we should meet there. He was teasing me, trying me. The suggestions comforted her as she rang, told Julie she had changed her mind, and would go to the ball, and she subsequently dined with her uncle and aunt, who seemed in exceedingly good spirits. Sir Thomas' pet project was that Lord Vansittart should marry Joan, and he augured well from his appearance at this juncture, and went through the ceremony of dressing with a certain amount of patience, when she stood before her long glass, with all the electric lights switched on, and saw herself in her gleaming white and shining pearls, tall, queenly, fair, with the glistening wreaths of golden hair crowning her small head, and her lustrous brown eyes alive with that peculiar, unfathomable expression which had gained her the epithet sphinx-like more than once when she was discussed as the beauty who meant to flout every beast that approached her, and did she felt comforted. Only when she was shut into the carriage, her aunt prattling platitudes, and the flickering street lamps flashing stray gleams into the dimly lit vehicle as they drove along, was she seized with a sudden panic. "I feel as if he does not come I shall break down, utterly I shall not be able to bear my life any more," she told herself, despondently. "I shall end it all, no one will care. There is only old Nana, who is barely alive, and she would follow me at once." The Duke of Arran was a man of ideas and he lived to carry them out. The balls and entertainments at Arran House were always unique. That evening was no exception. As Joan alighted, and passing through the hall accompanied Lady Thorne through the vestibule and up the wide staircase, even she felt transient admiration. White and gold everywhere was the rule tonight at Arran House, where the famous marble staircase had been brought from an old Venetian palazzo. This evening's decorations were carried out in gold-yellow, after the gardens and houses had been denuded of gold and white flowers to the disgust of the ducal gardeners. The London florists had been commissioned to supply the banks and wreaths and festoons of gold and white blossoms which everywhere met the eye, perfumed the atmosphere, and made a fitting background for the large staff of tall, handsome powdered men servants in black velvet and satin liveries, which was augmented tonight into a very regiment. One sickening glance round the magnificent ballroom, full of delicately beautiful toilettes, bright with flowers, lights, and laughter, gay with the music of a well-known band, told her Vansittart was not there. However, she maintained her composure. He might yet come, and with her usual chilly indifference allowed her few privileged friends to inscribe their initials on her tiny tablet. New partners she declined, with the plea of fatigue. But it was weary work. She was just telling herself, fiercely, that she could bear no more. She was seeking Lady Thorne to implore a retreat, when she came upon Vansittart talking pleasantly to her aunt in a cool corner. "I was waiting for you," he said, looking into her eyes and reading in them that which fired his blood. "You will give me this dance?" "Yes," she said, and she accompanied him, meek, silent, subdued, and allowing him to encircle her slight waist with a firm, proprietary clasp, glided round and round to the dreamy melody of the Bien-Aimé Valse. Once before, When she had first longed for his love, and felt the throes of this overwhelming life passion, they had danced together to that swaying, suggestive melody. He remembered how to feel her slight form almost in his embrace had urged him into a reckless avowal of a love which was promptly rejected. He set his teeth. He was at a white heat again and she? By some subtle sense he believed his moment had come. "I must speak to you," he hoarsely said, as they halted, Joan wide and breathless with emotion. "May I?" She looked up into his eyes, and at the intensity of the appealing, passionate abandonment to his will in that gaze, he thrilled with triumph. "We will go into the Duchess's boudoir, I know we may," he said, feeling a little giddy as he escorted her along a corridor and through the drawing rooms. The boudoir was empty, one or two couples only were seated in the adjacent anteroom. He saw at a glance they were well occupied with their own flirtations. He closed the door, drew the embroidered satin portiere across. They were alone in the dimly lighted room. He turned to her as she stood gazing at him, pale, fascinated. He took her hands. "Joan," he said then, as he felt her passion, he simply drew her into his arms, and stooping, kissed her lips, a long, passionate kiss. To feel his lips on hers was ecstasy to her. For a few moments she forgot all it was like heaven before its time. Then she feebly pushed him away, and gave a low moan. "Oh! What have I done?" she wailed, and she glanced about like a hunted creature. "How could you? You love me. What is to keep us asunder?" he hoarsely cried. As she sank shuddering, gasping, into a chair, he fell at her knees, and embraced them. "I am the happiest man on earth. For your uncle will approve, and you, Joan. All that was wanted was your love to make you my dear wife." "Wife?" She sank back and groaned. "I shall never be any man's wife," she said. "Why?" "Because I do not want to be. That is all. Because I never shall and will be." Was she crazy? He rose, slowly, and contemplated her. No. There were anguish and suffering in the lines about her mouth and eyes in those lustrous, strained brown orbs, but no insanity. "We must talk it all over. I may see you tomorrow, may I not?" he gently said, drawing a chair near, and seating himself between her and the door. He besought at least one interview, so that they should understand each other. He had but just obtained a reluctant consent to a __tete_ on the morrow, when the door suddenly opened, a gay young voice cried, "Surely there can't be anyone in here." And a bright face peeped round the curtain and at once disappeared. "Lady Violet!" exclaimed Joan, starting up. "She has seen us." "And if she has?" asked her lover, mystified by her terror at having been discovered alone with him by the Duke's eldest daughter. Still, with the promise of an elucidatory interview, he obeyed her wishes, and left her to return to the ballroom without his escort. She did not linger, she almost fled, scared, from the boudoir through the drawing rooms, into the corridor, which way led to the ballroom. Hesitating, glancing right and left, she saw one of the picturesque black-clad servitors coming towards her. She would ask him. As he advanced, the man's face riveted her attention. Not because of its swank's mask-like regularity, and the intent, glittering stare of the black eyes which fixed themselves boldly upon her own, but because the countenance was singularly like one which haunted her memory, waking and sleeping the hideous ghost of her foolish past. "Heavens, how terribly like him!" she murmured to herself, unconsciously, involuntarily shrinking back against the wall as he came near. "Like?" As the man came up, and halted, she gave a strangled cry like the pitiful dying wail of a poor hare. "I see, you recognize me," he said, in a low voice, with a bitter little smile. "Don't be alarmed. I am not going to claim you publicly, here, tonight. But if you do not want me to call and send in my credentials at your uncle's house, you will meet me tomorrow at the old place, in the evening. I shall be there at 8, and will wait till you come. Do you understand?" "Yes," she whispered. As he passed on and opening a baize door, disappeared, she stood gazing after him as if his words had been a sword thrust, and she was a dead woman. Chapter 4. Joan stood in the corridor, white, hardly breathing, as if turned to stone, her beautiful eyes riveted on the spot where the man who was once her lover had disappeared. "Victor?" she thought, as her whole being seemed to writhe in an agony of despair. "Victor, and in the Duke's livery, am I mad?" She gave a wild laugh, and the sudden sound startled her into sanity. Numbness had followed the shock of seeing the man living, in the flesh, whom she had hoped against hope was dead. Now she seemed to come to life again. She clenched her nails into her gloved hands so vehemently that the fine kid was rent. She suppressed her almost ungovernable desire to groan out her misery, and as she set her teeth and closed her eyes to realize the situation and deal with it, She seemed to see her soul naked within her, and it was ablaze with one dominating passion alone love for Vansittart. I am all his, she slowly told herself. How I have become so I never wished it nature, fate, the creator who made us, alone, no. But I am his, he is my lord and master, and whatever comes between me and him must be trodden underfoot. Her whole being, violently shocked and almost outraged by the sudden blow, the reappearance of the unscrupulous man who had dared to annex her fair young girlhood and chain it to his fouled existence, rose and asserted itself in a strong, overpowering will to belong to Vansittart, its rightful owner by legitimate conquest, against all and every obstacle. The feeling was so huge, so powerful, she felt as a very feather in its grasp, she was awed by it, but strengthened. I will, I must be his, and I shall be. She told herself, feeling as if the words had uttered themselves prophetically, by some mysterious agency, within her soul. And she quietly returned to the ballroom, calmed, for she was as an almost automaton, swayed by some obsessive spirit which had asserted itself when she was half wild with despair. Entering the ballroom, she saw Vansittart, pale, his eyes laden with emotion, watching for her just within the doorway. The heat, the buzz, the patter of feet upon the parquet, they were dancing a cotillon, the braying of the band, took her aback in her strained, nervous state for a moment. Then she recovered herself and went up to him. Take me to Auntie, she said, smiling up at him. But first, one word. Do I look ill? I feel so I am subject to horrid neuralgia, and it has just begun. I am distracted with pain. I shall be in bed all day tomorrow, I am sure. Put off coming till the day after, won't you? Was it a dream, an illusion, her confiding, tender manner, that sweet appealing look in those adored, beautiful eyes? Vansittart felt suddenly weak and tremulous as he drew her hand within his arm. She loved him. He was certain of it. She loved him. She had not known it till he dared all in that passionate kiss. He vaguely felt himself the Pygmalion who had awakened another Galatea. My darling, I am afraid it is my fault, he murmured in her ear, as he conveyed her towards the corner where Lady Thorne sat patiently listening to the prattle of the surrounding dowagers, and trying not to wish the evening at an end. How dear of you to say no. Of course I will postpone coming. But I may call and inquire? No? Very well. You have only to command me, my queen, my adored. Could it be real, that faint pressure of his arm, as he looked fondly down upon that lovely little golden head? Vansittart almost lost his grip upon himself, almost forgot to act the mere amiable cavalier, as he accompanied Joan and her inwardly relieved and delighted aunt to the cooler regions of the ducal establishment, and after vainly pressing them to take some refreshment, found their carriage. As he stood bareheaded under the awning after they had driven off, he glanced up at the sky. It had been raining, and now a wreath of cloud had parted to disclose a misty moon and a vague but real remorse that he had not kept up with the noble truths he had learned at his dead mother's knee in those days which seemed a century or more ago brought the moisture to his happy eyes. God forgive me, I do not deserve her, was the honest prayer which went up from his overladen heart as he turned, somewhat giddily, and tried to walk into the ducal mansion without the unsteadiness which might lead some of those priggish menservants to imagine he had dined rather too well than wisely. But, if I only can succeed in making her my own, her life shall be a royal one. Would he have felt so triumphantly joyful if he could have seen his beloved, after they parted? Arrived at home, Joan dismissed her maid as soon as she could get rid of her without exciting any suspicion, and spent a night's vigil in facing the situation. She remembered her innocent, ignorant school days when, infected by the foolish talk of frivolous elder girls, they were mostly daughters of rich parents, Joan's godmother paid for the education which could not be afforded by the poor clergyman and his invalid wife. She was flattered by the admiring gaze of a handsome young man who watched her in church each Sunday from his seat in a neighboring pew. Schoolgirl talk of him led to chance glances of hers in response. Then came a note artfully dropped by him and picked up by a school friend, delighted to feel herself one of the underscore dramatis personae underscore in a living love play. This and ensuing love letters proved the young man a clever scribe. He represented himself as a member of a distinguished family, banished from home on account of his political opinions. The secret correspondence continued, then, with the assistance of a bribed housemaid whose mental pabulum was low-class novelettes with impossible illustrations of 7-feet-high countesses and their elongated curly-haired lovers, there were brief, passionate meetings. When Joan was just recovering from her grief at her father's recent death, the climax came. Her mother died, her lawyers sent for her. When she returned to school, it was with the knowledge that the rich uncle intended to take her from thence, why and for what she did not know, that her godmother acknowledged his right to deal with her future, and that her days in C were numbered. With what agony and humiliation she remembered that next wildly emotional meeting with the man she fancied she loved, his passionate pleading that she would be his, her reluctant consent, their meeting in town a few weeks later when she had boldly fled from school to her old nurse in the little suburban house where she let lodgings, and their marriage before the registrar, to attain which Victor Mercier had falsely stated her age, and their parting immediately after. She went to her uncle somewhat in disgrace because of her precipitate flight from school. But her beauty and the pathos of her orphanhood, also a secret remorse on his part for his hard-heartedness to her dead parents, induced him to consider it a girlish freak alone, and to ignore it as such. She had hardly become settled in her new, luxurious home when the blow fell which at first seemed to shatter her whole life at once and forever. She read in a daily paper of a discovered fraud in the branch office at C, of a London house, and of the flight and disappearance of the manager, Victor Mercier. To recall those succeeding days and weeks of secret anguish, fear, dread and sickening horror, made her shiver even now. In her desperation she had confided in her old nurse. But for her, I should have gone mad. She told herself, with a shudder. You will never see him again, my pretty, all you have to do is to forget the brute. Was the burden of Nurse Todd's song of consolation. Such as him dare never show his face at Sir Thomas. Your husband? The law 'ud soon rid ye of a husband of his sort. But there won't be no call for that. He's as dead as a doornail in this country and, you're not likely ever to see him again. And now he had come to life, and in the Duke's livery. He was one of the auxiliaries, of course. Joan told herself. But how does he dare to be here? If only I had the courage to tell Uncle all. I believe he might forgive me. But I could never face Vincent again if he knew. It would be giving up his love, and that I will not do. No, she must endure her second martyrdom in secret, as she endured the first. There was nothing else to be done. And, she must become that most subtle of all actresses, the actress in real life. Morning came, and she declared herself too unwell with an attack of neuralgia to rise. Her aunt came up and petted her, and she was left in a darkened room until evening when she sat up for a little. You need not stay in tonight, Julie, she told her maid, a devoted, if somewhat frivolous girl. Her uncle and aunt, satisfied she was better, had gone out to a dinner with her she should rightly have accompanied them. Tell them not to disturb me unless I ring. I shall go to bed directly and get a long sleep. Julie left her, half reluctant, half eager, for her evening out lying cozily on a soft sofa, the last new novel from the library open in her hands. As soon as she considered that those among the servants who indulged in surreptitious outings were clear of the premises, and the supper bell had summoned the others to the favorite meal of the day, she rose, dressed herself in a short cycling costume and a long cloak, tied a veil over her smallest, plainest hat, took a latchkey she had once laughingly stolen from her uncle, but had never yet used, and after locking her door and pocketing a key, crept quietly downstairs, crossed the deserted hall, and shut herself out into the warm, cloudy night. Chapter 5. The big mansion of which she was the pampered, cherished darling, lay solemn, pompous, solid, dark, behind her. Before her, the pavement, wet after a summer shower, shone in the lamplight. Dark, waving shadows against the driving clouds, with their fitful patches of moonlit sky, were the trees in the enclosure, dangled by the wind. She hurried along, turning down the first by street she came to and emerging at its end into one of the principal thoroughfares. She hailed a crawling hansom. Regent's Park. Clarence Gate, she said, in a muffled voice, as she sprang lightly in. To be dashing along the lighted streets to meet the absconded swindler who had dared to take advantage of her girlish folly to make her his wife by law, was delirious work. Cowering back in the corner of the hansom, she gazed with sickened misery at the gay shop windows, at the crowded omnibuses, at the cheery passengers who carelessly stepped along the pavement, looking as if all life were matter of fact, plain sailing, above board. 100 shrill voices seemed clamoring in her ears. Turn back. Face the worst, but be honest. She had almost flung up her arm and, opening the trap, bid the driver return, when the memory of Vincitard, of his love, of his kiss came surging upon her with redoubled force. If I am a coward, I shall lose him, cried her whole nature, fiercely. No. She must battle through, she must circumvent her enemy, the enemy to her love, and Vincitard's. But how? I will dare him, was her instinct. I will tell him to claim me if he can. But that was the madness of passion. Reason bade her use other means. One must fight a man with his own weapons, she told herself, as the hansom dashed along Gloucester Place, and she knew her time was short. It was now nearer 9 than 8. She had seen that by an illuminated clock over a shop. _ _he_ _ was to be at their trysting place of old, when she had lodged with her old nurse in a street in Camden Town, at 8. He lied to me from the first moment to the last. I must lie to him. I will pretend I have cared for him. It will put him off his guard, she thought, as, with a double fee to the cabman, who said thank ye, miss, with odious familiarity, she scurried away in the darkness, and crossing the wet road, turned up that which led to the inner circle. There was no chance of forgetting the spot where they two had last met. As she neared it, a slim, dark figure stepped out from the shadow. "My wife," he exclaimed, in emotional tones. He would have embraced her, but she slipped away and leant up against the paling. "You can call me that after leaving me all these years not knowing whether you were alive or dead," she panted hoarsely. Under any circumstances emotion was natural, so she made no effort to conceal it. "I? It was you who would not reply to my letters," he exclaimed bitterly. "I wrote again and again, under cover to your miserable old nurse, and don't say you never had them. The last came back to me not known. But the others did not. They would have if they had not reached. If she had them, she never gave them to me," she said truthfully. "And I don't wonder. I was so utterly wretched when I read of your flight that I told her all. I had to. I should have gone raving mad if I had kept it to myself. Well, all that is over and done with, thank goodness," he exclaimed, cheerfully, after a brief pause. "I will not scold you for misjudging me. You are but a child. But you are a woman now, of age, your own mistress. I have been fortunate of late, or I should not be here. Speculations of mine have turned up trumps, and not only that, but I have friends in the city who'll introduce me to your uncle, and if you only play your cards well, our real wedding shall be followed by a sham one, and Mrs. Victor Acourt will take a very nice place in society. My dear, cash opens all doors, and I have it. Someone is coming," she said feebly. His speech had called forth all her powers of endurance, and, while bracing herself to bear up as she did, nature determinedly asserted itself. She felt cold and giddy. Her limbs seemed as if they did not belong to her. "Only a bobby," he said, with a light vulgarity which seemed the last straw. As she turned to walk along by his side, she tottered. "Don't do that, or the bobby will think you are drunk," he said, coarsely, holding her up by the arm. His detested touch achieved what her slackening courage had failed to do. She felt suddenly strong with a new, fierce emotion. Was it hate? "I cannot understand how you can be well off, or, indeed, how you can be here at all," she softly began, as the policeman marched solemnly on before them, the light of one of the occasional lamps gleaming on his wet weather cape. "I thought." "You mean, your old nurse thought," he went on angrily. "You were not capable of suspecting me, if that old wretch had not put it into your head. My love, I was a victim of circumstances. The people I was with were a rotten lot. They accused me to protect themselves. They were bankrupt 3 years ago. Mercier was not my real name. My father was Victor Mercier Acourt. It suited me to use it, that's all. What, you don't believe me?" "You told me lies, then why should I believe you?" she boldly said. "Because you are my wife. It will not pay me to tell you untruths, nor will it pay you to doubt me," he savagely retorted. "I had expected a welcome. Instead, I am treated like this. It is enough to exasperate a saint, and I don't profess to be that. Come, let us talk business, as you don't feel inclined for love. You are mine, and I mean to have you. You understand? I have waited for you all these years, and precious hard work it has been, I can tell you, for plenty of girls as good-looking as you made a dead set at me, and girls with loads of oof, too. If I don't get you by fair means, I will have you by foul. It is for you to select. By jingo, it would serve you right if I went to that wretched uncle of yours tomorrow, and claimed you." She stopped short and confronted him. The moon, breaking through the driving clouds, shone full on her face. Beautiful, corpse-like in its somber, set expression, there was that in her great, shining eyes which gave him, hardened worldling though he was, a slight shock. He felt he had gone too far. "Drop the tragedy, queen, do, and be my own little darling."